It's 821 News Radio WJPF. My good friend, Dr. Terry Brown, certified sleep specialist, joining me in the studio. First off, Doctor, it's good to see you again, buddy.
Good to see you again, Tom. Yes. Really well.
Yeah. Staying out of trouble, I hope.
Yep.
I'm good. You working on anything fun, research?
Well, we're doing that one study, you know, with Southern Illinois University, where we're looking at Dr. Dollinger and her graduate student, where we're looking at cognitive improvement after CPAP. In other words, pre and post cognitive testing, and that's going pretty well. I think I think it'll be finished probably by summertime.
And you and I have a pretty good gut feeling, but you're a scientist and you're a research scientist, so you get the numbers.
Right.
But what I know of it personally has been secondhand anecdotal evidence, and almost universally, it is, oh, my God, I didn't know how sick I was until I was well again. That there's a seemingly ever-present status that can be developed through not getting a decent night's sleep, not breathing well, blood gases are off, and all this stuff that you and I have talked about in the past. And what I find most interesting is the way people's personality change. So you know cognitive abilities aren't far behind when your mood changes. You enjoy more what you do. You're more focused. I'm really curious to see how this turns out. You've been working on this for a couple of years, haven't you?
Yeah, it's been about that long. We've taken some preliminary peeks at the data, and it looks like that the one item that clearly seems to improve after CPAP was attention, alertness type things, concentration.
I don't doubt it for a second. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how it turns out. You know, at some point, somebody over the weekend said, boy, I'm glad the weekend's here. I can finally catch up on my sleep. And that was a notion that I kind of subscribed to until, of course, I met you. I know you can get the sleep you need, but you can't really catch up.
You really don't catch up in a one-to-one ratio, and we don't really know if undersleeping sometimes and sleeping a little longer other times is damaging or not, really. But clearly undersleeping is. So that's the problem. If people have to catch up on the weekends, they're not sleeping enough during the week.
And here's the thing. The National Sleep Foundation has issued these new guidelines. They were really more of a fine-tuning type deal. But it seemed more was the subtext to all of it. I mean, when you look at newborns 0 to 3 months, probably not any surprise that they believe that a newborn between 0 and 3 months should get 14 to 17 hours sleep. That's probably not a stretch for many people. But infants, 12 to 15 hours. Sometimes it's kind of hard to get infants and toddlers, which are toddlers are 11 to 14 hours. Sometimes it's hard to achieve that with sometimes uncooperative two-year-olds in particular.
Nowadays, especially.
Yeah, there's so many distractions. Mm-hmm. Preschoolers, 3 to 5, 10 to 13 hours. School-age children, we're talking about the ones 6 to 13 years of age, 9 to 11 hours. This is something you and I have talked about quite a bit. This is a good standard.
Yeah, it sounds reasonable.
And you know, what's interesting in this is school-age children, it's a crucial time. What happens when a 6 to a 13-year-old sleeps? How many different important things are going on?
Well, I mean, there's still some growth hormone, you know, secretion going on in the first part of the night. And to fully grow, the kid will need that, you know. So growth hormone and deep sleep sort of drop off as we get older. But even elderly adults need a certain amount of growth hormone.
All right. Now, when it comes to this, obesity is also a subtext in this growth hormone, isn't it?
That's right. There's a lot of evidence that kids who don't spend enough hours in bed, usually considered less than 7 or 8, are more prone to obesity.
Teenagers, 14 to 17, 8 to 10 hours. I mean, it's almost a cliche about teenagers and sleep, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So really not so hard to...
Right. They're definitely undersleeping, so I do hope... some of the teenagers themselves read that, you know.
What's interesting is this 14 to 17 and the 18 to 25 younger adults, 7 to 9 hours. And that's a pretty good difference, really, mm-hmm. 7 to 9. In my world, 7's a big difference from 9. What's interesting is I talked to law enforcement about people in this age group who are new to driving and if they have jobs. I spoke to more than one. He says, man, this is that 12 to 1 to 2 o'clock. And a 16 or 17-year-old behind the wheel who has a job driving home at late, it's a dangerous time for them because they really need this sleep.
That's right. You hear a lot of things about kids, you know, maybe even later, two or three, you know, they just ran off the road and hit a tree, and there was no alcohol or drugs involved, and so we have to assume they went to sleep.
Younger adults, as we said, 7 to 9, this is a new age category in this National Sleep Foundation number, and then adults, 26 to 64, 7 to 9 hours, and then older adults, 65 and older, 7 to 8 hours, which is another one you hear many people are older going, eh, I can't sleep. You know, what's almost uniformly now that I'm getting closer to these ages is I hear, oh, I could sleep if, you know, somebody put a catheter in. You hear that too?
Yeah, yeah. I thought sometimes older adults, you know, just have to, like, you know, maybe they might have to make up part of it with a nap if they can't sleep enough hours in a row, you know.
I didn't know if nap has to be a viable option for me. But I really didn't look at it as a healthy option, to be honest with you, because it costs you your night's sleep, a good night's sleep later.
It can, especially for some people. Yeah. Some people can get away with a nap, but those are usually the good sleepers anyway.
Right. I think if you create a habit, mm-hmm. you know, maybe it kind of sustains itself.
Yeah, you do get conditioned to go to sleep at the usual times you're used to going to sleep, you know.
You look at this, and from a practical outside looking in standpoint, it doesn't seem like a problem. But in your office, you know that it is for people.
Right, and we see it mostly in the younger teenagers and college students that are undersleeping. And some of them get referred, you know, for sleep apnea, and the real problem may be in some cases that they're just not spending enough time in bed.
Yeah, and when they do, they're conking out. I mean, isn't it weird because when you really conk out, when you, that deep, deep, deep sleep that you yearn for, that's that most restful, it turns out you start sucking for air and wind and snoring things. I hear more and more about snoring, and I'm not sure whether I'm hearing about people with sinus conditions or a symptom of obesity or something else. But snoring is a big deal for a lot of people, especially if you've got a companion.
Right. You know, anything that could produce narrowing of the airway will produce that turbulence, and that produces the sound.
It's interesting because when you were talking about the CPAP system, and sleep apnea, that this new research that was done, you and I only got to briefly talk about it on the phone the other day, is it appears as though women, according to this new information, women are being underdiagnosed for sleep apnea. I guess they present a little differently?
Yeah, I think I'm sure that they are being underdiagnosed, but the oddball thing is we have about 50-50 men and women, and that may be counterbalanced by the idea that women are more likely to go to doctors than men are. So it may actually, in terms of what we see, it may, in fact, we've sometimes been a little higher on women than we have on men. But that may still, as far as the difference in presentation, though, women aren't going to do the really loud snoring. You know, they're going to do the slight snoring that nobody notices, and then they stop breathing, and nobody notices that either, you know.
I would customarily argue that point, but my lifespan cries for me to stop now. The word might get out. You're not going to believe what he said about your snoring this morning, so I'm just going to be quiet. But I can tell you, from a non-typical standpoint, oh, I'd argue the point. But everybody's different than
that's right.
But it was interesting in this report, it said that women present with sleep apnea. And, you know, when we call it sleep apnea, but I find it so much more effective, Dr. Brown, when we say you stop breathing while you're sleeping. That seems to have some penetration when the message is spoken. We have sleep apnea.
We have that, too. You know, like I can show the patient their waveforms from their study, and when they see that flat line, when they see that the wavy line went flat, they understand exactly better than ever what's happening there.
And how many times have you had a wife standing in going, no, honey, you stop breathing while you...
Right, and the husband,
and then you stop,
right,
and see what you've. I mean, women are going, wait a second, the person that I care for in my life has stopped breathing next to me, and then you wait a second to see if they start again.
That's right. They're calling it the elbow sign. You know, is the vernacular now.
I like that and realistic. You know, I'm curious about something else when it comes to sleep apnea, because you and I don't always touch this particular aspect of it. But the fact is, if you are not breathing and breathing well, ask any athlete. And breathe right strips and all things. Get as much oxygen in that system because you got a fire burning in your system and it needs oxygen to go. The blood gases and its relationship to how you feel the next day, all day, when you have sleep apnea.
Yeah, well, we'll kind of be looking at that, you know, whether it's the arousals from having to wake up to breathe or whether it's the oxygen going down that causes the cognitive and other effects, we might be able to tease out from our data, I'm hoping. But some studies have suggested that the oxygen going down may be a bit more crucial. And if you think about it, it's not good. Oxygen going down a third of your life is not good for any organ system.
Well,
and you had that issue about skin.
About
right?
skin.
That even your skin ages faster if you have sleep apnea and your oxygen's going down at night or you're not getting enough sleep or whatever.
But see, this is an in and out system. In the oxygen, out goes the bad. So your bad components start to build up in your blood gas as well because you're not purging your system correctly.
That's correct. And we measure that under certain circumstances, mostly with children or adult patients with COPD.
One of the other items that if you are a single person and you have sleep apnea and you're using a CPAP system, that if your system, I'm learning this from a friend of mine who struggled with this problem, if it's not connected and working properly, you may not know. You have to check whether you've got a good seal and whether that system is working, because you're unconscious. Does the system have a self-diagnostic?
Most of the systems in the last 4 or 5 years have a smart card system that tells us not only how much the patient uses it, but also what the apnea hypopnea index is, in other words, how many times you stop breathing while you're on it, and also how much leak you've got. It quantifies the leak, and we know for each mask about how much leak to expect. So if it exceeds that, then we know you've got a problem. But then sometimes the patient will know they have a problem as well.
All right, ready for the awkward question of the day?
Sure.
Is depression a sleep disorder?
Well, that's a difficult question. I think there's a big overlap would probably be the safest thing to say. You know, a lot of the depression inventories ask about fatigue and things like that, and there is a correlation between Beck depression scores and the Epworth sleepiness questionnaire. There's a good positive correlation between those two. They're highly related, but lots of cases, probably as much as 50% of insomnia complaints are not related to depression.
They're related to, what is the number
sleep
one?
Apnea.
Yeah, what, sleep apnea, is
it's
it number
starting
one?
To be sleep apnea number one, yeah.
Really? See, now, I would have thought that was interesting because my first thought, I fully expect you to say, because I can't make my brain stop.
Right, that's what people report. But, you know, if you take normal controls in a research setting and oversleep them, they will also say that they can't make their brain stop, basically. So if your sleep drive is satiated, then you'll have that epiphenomenon of not being able to stop your thoughts, and people describe it various ways. But
yeah, the voices, which, you know, sometimes when they say the voices,
slide
you take
their
a
chair
double
away,
check,
huh?
Right? Well, we were talking with Mike Pinto last week. He does these speeches, you know, about branding and things like that, and you know, life is just like one long conversation with yourself, really.
It really
is. You know, and then some people at night with me, it's what am I going to do tomorrow? What question am I asked Dr. Brown in one order? And then I run my
work it all out in your sleep.
And
huh?
I work it out in my sleep. I literally do. But you know, but when you read about people who are say, look, I have depression so bad, I can't get out of bed. I didn't know whether it was a sleep disorder or that was a refuge. My first gut instinct is you sleep so you don't have to face reality. That the dream.
Certainly, that's an element of depression, I would say. But some people actually, you know, get that insomnia complaint because they have tried to escape and they've spent too much time in bed and they've overslept. So if you've overslept a little bit, you will tend to wake up the subsequent sleep opportunity. You'll wake up more.
You know, we're coming up to an interesting time of the year. Days get longer, more VU, because I get spring fever. First off, I thought it was sex oriented, and it's really not. Mm-hmm. It's light exposure, and you're more. It's because the human body, after centuries and centuries and centuries, has got kind of a slow period for its own self preservation through the winter, during the lean months, and when spring comes, your body reacts by going, it's time to get to work. It's time to hunt and gather. Mm-hmm. It's time to plant and check on the animals. That there's this. Your body ramps up. I see it in the form of aggressive behavior behind the wheel as well in springtime.
Interesting.
At least my outside, I'm not as scientific as you. I rely on anecdotal evidence. So,
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's definitely a winter hibernation tendency because of the decrease in light, you know. And I think everybody does feel a little better. I noticed it myself, you know, that the sun comes up a little
elevated
earlier.
Mood.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I seem to get alert faster, you know, so just because of the sunlight.
And a little sense of anticipation, I think, you know, mm-hmm. that it's coming, something's
especially
coming.
Especially when you start hearing the birds tweeting, you know, and it's kind of like, hey, it's time to get up.
It's we respond to it. You know, what's interesting is after the years that I've known you, I've always been preoccupied with being happy. It seems like what we're supposed to do as human beings. We're supposed to grow up, be happy with what we do, and be pleased. I don't think we're born and raised to be miserable creatures. And over the years, and especially meeting you, that I've realized the role that a good night's sleep and having some regard for this, because, and I've told you this before, for many years I considered sleep a body function akin to going to the bathroom, something I've got to do. Really don't like it, but I got to do it. And as time goes by, I've started treating the way I sleep differently, and as a sense, when I do it successfully, it has premiums. It pays off.
It really does. It makes you much faster in your analysis of things and even fluency of speech, you know.
So that's why I'm probably particularly more happy, because the things that are most important to me to do a good job, I get whenever I get my good night's sleep.
Yeah, and you start noticing it more, you know, when you get good sleep. When you're younger, you don't notice it too much. But as you get older, you start saying, hey, I slept well last night. It must be why I'm so sharp today, you know, and you can feel it.
Well, I think as a youth, it's not so much to recognize it. You just take it for granted.
That's right.
You know, because
you say, it's a burden. You want to do things, so yeah. You don't want to have to sleep.
You know, you find out you're only immortal for a limited time.
Right.
And you grow up and you realize there are certain components that can contribute to your well-being, your productivity, how much other people like you because you're not crabby,
mm-hmm.
And that all along you're unconscious for all this important, crucial time. That's the problem I think we have.
Yeah. Well, it's possible to, like, you know, even though we're unconscious, we're productive, as you're saying. You're reviewing memories that you need to keep. You're erasing some that you don't. You're pruning some you don't need to keep. So that's a particularly important function of sleep.
And your body's taking out the garbage.
That's right.
When I say not to the emotional brain cell, gray cell, you know, type, your body is performing repair functions, growth functions, and on a physiological level, it's cleaning house.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other things, too. I mean, this tie-in with obesity, I think, once again, goes under it. Is it a coincidence at the same time? We're going through an obesity epidemic in this country. The Center for Disease Control says we're going through an epidemic of not sleeping. I don't think those two things are coincidences.
Right. Yeah, they're highly related.
But the question is, how do we fix it? I mean, your sleep ritual, your sleep hygiene ideas, before we go to today, in particular, if you have trouble sleeping, there are some options that don't require pills. Mm-hmm. I mean, we sell a lot of sleeping pills,
right.
But I've switched over to the more organic, you know, not taking mm-hmm. barbiturates or anything along that line. There's some great ideas out there. You just need a couple of, you need a little melatonin, you need your serotonin. You've got to have these good chemicals. They're crucial in your mood, your standards, who
right.
you are.
Yeah. You know, some people actually develop an insomnia problem and they start spending more time in bed to try to compensate for it, and sometimes that can actually make it worse, you know, like they're, because if you spend more time in bed more than you need, you can make a normal control an insomniac if you make them spend 12 hours in bed every night, for example.
What do you think about melatonin?
It seems to be helpful for a portion of people. You know, the preparations are all non-standardized because they're not prescription, and so you don't really know how, if you know, 5 milligrams from this one brand is the same as 5 milligrams from another brand. So there's a lot of unknowns, but I do encounter people all the time where it's helped, you know.
You could count me on that list.
Mm-hmm.
But I take close to 10 milligrams.
Mm-hmm.
I take what I see, because it's weird that you mentioned this, because one of my biggest concerns, if I change brands, am I getting the same? If you chew it up, does it work faster just before you go to bed? But, you know, about 8, sometimes as many as 12 milligrams of melatonin a day for me before mm-hmm. in the 30 to 40 minutes prior to going to bed.
Yeah, I've heard of people taking up to that much without much problem.
And I stay away from bright screens for an hour mm-hmm. before I go to bed. TV, yes, but no telephone, no tablet 10 inches from my face, mm-hmm. no bright UV. And there's been a lot of research that backs this up, too.
Right. The blue light tends to really wake you up.
And you know, it's easy enough. You can just go over to the screen on the laptop if you must and turn it down.
Mm-hmm.
There's controls there as well. So what's your final thoughts on getting a good night's sleep from certified sleep specialist Dr. Terry Brown? If you're having struggles, where do you start on your own before you come and see Dr. Brown?
Probably, just analyze your sleep schedule, keep a sleep diary, look at your sleep pattern for 7 to 14 days in a row, I'd say is probably the first place to start. And then you may notice some problems yourself just from creating that diary.
Going to bed at the same time
mm-hmm.
is a good baseline way to start as well.
Yes, and getting up at the same time in view of the sun exposure may actually be slightly more important than going to bed at the same time, but they're both important.
How precise is the circadian clock in a human being? I'm a firm believer it's down to the minute.
Usually it's over 24 hours in most younger to middle-aged people. Some elderly people have a period that's shorter than 24 hours. So you really need that sun exposure to reset your clock to the current season of the year and things like that, you know.
UV exposure.
Right.
Through the eyes or on the skin?
Well, it looks like the eyes primarily, because we have this we have actually two tracks that go from the eyes to the suprachiasmic nucleus, which is the circadian clock.
The nuclear clock of the human body.
There you go. And so two fibers basically go from the retina to there. And even in lots of blind people, those things are still intact. So light can affect their sleep cycle as well. They do have the non-24 syndrome. A portion of blind people don't have those connections between the retina and the clock intact, so they may have a non-24 cycle. They may actually just move around the clock, you know.
Yeah, well, I can see that if your blindness involved retina detachment,
mm-hmm.
that the rods and cones can't send the signal back to the clock to reset every day.
Right.
Just like this clock behind me does to touch the atomic register so that it knows what to reset my clock on the wall.
That's right. It has to, exactly, a very good analogy, Tom, because
That's
what the sun's doing, exactly the same thing.
It's telling you, mm-hmm. telling your body what time it is
right,
in the
satellite's
world.
In sync with that, and
yeah.
And it resets it. It gets off periodically a little bit, but that satellite will reset it.
You know, there's a lot of good advice here from Dr. Brown if you want to get in touch with him if you're not getting a night's sleep, because all I can tell you is that as you get older, I cherish my sleep and my rituals more often. But having a sleep ritual, turning the clock, which I learned from you, away from me, since I'm a math person, I have 7 hours, 12 minutes. I have 6 hours, 58 minutes. I mean, I literally do the math.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 3 hours, 19 minutes. I mean, I literally... Turning
right.
that clock sideways, by the way, Doc. Thanks for that one. That's a chestnut right there,
well,
my friend.
Plus you're not getting exposed to the light of the clock either.
So. Yeah, that's true. There's that, too, even though it is red, not the blue light. Dr. Terry Brown, certified sleep specialist. Always a privilege, Dr. Brown.
Thanks, Tom.